Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the online news site The Intercept reported over the weekend that an FBI informant who had allegedly infiltrated the Trump campaign in 2016 is the same person who oversaw a CIA operation in 1980 to infiltrate the Jimmy Carter campaign. He reportedly did so at the urging of former CIA Director George H.W. Bush. How is all of this legal? And is Donald Trump right when he says the FBI was spying on him? Next, at least 10 prominent women's activists were arrested in Saudi Arabia over the weekend and today, just 6 weeks before the kingdom was supposed to lift its ban on women driving. Two men also were arrested. The women have been outspoken in their support of a woman's right to drive and in their opposition to the male guardianship system, where a woman may travel only with the permission of her father, husband, or brother. The arrested men are known for having created a literary salon that allows both men and women to attend. The government said that the activists had, quote, formed a cell that threatened Saudi security, unquote. Then we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education around the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then we begin a new weekly segment called Connected Lives, Private Profits, with Chris Garaffa. Chris will help us look at technological issues that shape our world and how we can fight to maintain our civil rights and civil liberties in the face of increasingly advanced and sometimes hostile technology. And finally, Kirill Vyshinsky, a reporter for RIA Novosti Ukraine, the Ukrainian bureau of the Russian news agency, was arrested in Kiev last week and charged with high treason. The Ukrainian government accuses Vyshinsky of, quote, subversion by means of information, unquote. The NGO Reporters Without Borders says that it is deeply worried about the journalist and is calling on the Ukrainian government to release him without delay. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the FBI and the scandal brewing there. The online news site The Intercept reported over the weekend that an FBI informant who had allegedly infiltrated the Trump campaign in 2016 is the same person who oversaw a CIA operation in 1980 to infiltrate the Jimmy Carter campaign. He reportedly did so at the urging of former CIA director and then vice presidential candidate George H.W. Bush. How is all of this legal? And is Donald Trump right when he says that the FBI was spying on him? We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can find his work at www.rall.com. Ted, welcome back.
Thanks.
Ted, let's start with that question. Is Donald Trump right when he says the FBI is spying on him?
Yeah, he's right. It's tempting to dismiss the words of a blowhard, but in this case, as he has been in other cases, the blowhard is telling the truth. By any objective definition, the FBI was spying on the Trump campaign. This guy, Stephen Halper, was clearly involved in doing exactly that. And there's really no other way you could interpret what he was up to.
You know, I can't help but to think that when Donald Trump says this stuff, for the first 5 seconds, it sounds crazy. And then when you actually look at it, I really believe that anybody with any analytic skills can come to the conclusion that, well, you know, there could be something to this. For example, he said here that the CIA, the intelligence community in general, was against him from the beginning, and the CIA was working openly against him. And then as it turns out, Mike Morrell, who's a lifelong Republican, not only endorsed Hillary Clinton in an op-ed in the New York Times, but claimed that Vladimir Putin had recruited Trump as what he called an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation. And that was just the beginning of it. You know, we've been getting bits and pieces of this really since the very beginning of the Trump presidency. You'll recall, Ted, when Donald Trump said that he had been wiretapped, he used a word that technologically isn't really used anymore, but the basic theme was correct, that information from the Trump campaign was being scooped up by NSA and possibly the CIA and probably the FBI to be later used against him.
That's right. And there's been multiple stories confirming that, kind of turning the Rubik's Cube around and looking at it from several points of view. And they all conclude the same thing. it's weird because, you know, you think if the deep state was so determined to sabotage or prevent Mr. Trump from becoming president, then how did he pull off this tremendous upset? But nevertheless, politics are weird, which is why people listen to this show.
Stephen Halper, the individual who was a spy in the Carter administration in 1980. And of course, we know that the Iranian government refused to release the hostages to Jimmy Carter during that whole time. And there was Gary Sick and others said that was the October surprise, that Iran was colluding with the Reagan administration so that the Iranians would not release the hostages, and thus Jimmy Carter looked weak. The 5 minutes after Ronald Reagan was sworn into office, January 20th, 1981, the Iran hostages were released. So that seemed to be sort of make a lot of sense. But Halper was there then. In the last couple of years, he received all sorts of money, $410,000 from the Department of Defense. I think it's classified about why. That was in 2016. In 2015, he received $244,000 from the Department of Defense, $204,000 in 2014. In 2012, Stephen Halper received $197,000. But what happened in this case, Ted Rawl, and just again, I want to recap it for the audience. George Papadopoulos was invited by Stephen Halper, the author and retired or academic, to come to the UK. He said he wanted him to write an article. He paid $3,000, and then he tried to talk to him and get him to admit how he knew, as he had supposedly said in a drunken exchange with the Australian ambassador, how the Russians were going to help Donald Trump by giving him information. George Papadopoulos said, "I don't know anything." He just said no. The guy got mad. Then he had his assistant, Stephen Halper, had his assistant take Papadopoulos out to, you know, ply him with drinks, basically. And again, Papadopoulos said, "I don't know anything." So who gave Stephen Halper the $3,000 to give to George Papadopoulos, who was at that time an informal foreign policy advisor to Donald Trump? Who did that?
Who knows? I mean, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, I'd say it's the FBI.
It could be the FBI or it could be the Pentagon, because we know now, just from the last couple of days, that federal records are showing that since 2012, which is only 5.5 years ago, the Pentagon think tank called the Office of Net Assessment has paid Halper $928,800 for analysis, whatever that means. So is it the Pentagon? Is it the FBI? Obviously, somebody in the federal government is paying this guy a lot of money, and we don't know yet what it is that he's producing.
And he gave some of that money to Papadopoulos, who was then indicted.
Exactly. And we also know, thanks to both The Intercept and the conservative outlet, The Daily Caller, that it wasn't just Papadopoulos that this Halper had been targeting. We know that this Halper had met with four different Trump campaign officials separately. We know he met with Carter Page, with George Papadopoulos, with Mike Flynn, and with Paul Manafort, all independently of one another. That tells me that he was tasked with separating these guys and trying to get them to say something or to do something that would put them in jeopardy. This is a classic intelligence operation.
It is a classic intelligence operation. It's amazing to me that anyone could call it anything other than spying. Some people have been trying to spin it on social media as saying the FBI doesn't spy. The FBI merely protects America from threats. But yeah, obviously the FBI spies. You can ask the Black Panthers whether the FBI spies or not.
Yes, indeed. I mean, every progressive movement, and that's the weird thing, you know, all progressive movements who have been spied on by the FBI, whose operations have targeted progressives, that's gone on over and over and over again. It went on with the Occupy movement. It's going on right now with the Black Lives Matter movement, again, under the leadership of James Comey, who's now loved by liberals. The FBI spies on people. That's what it does. Here you have congressional committees, John, that are supposed to be the oversight over the FBI. Donald Trump has just said, in lieu of this information, that the FBI had an informant targeting Trump campaign officials, that the FBI, the Department of Justice, should hand over to the congressional oversight committees all of the documents pertaining to this affair. And weirdly, Adam Schiff,
of all people,
who says he's in charge of congressional oversight on behalf of the Democratic Party, the leader in the House Intelligence Committee, says, no, we don't want these documents because they would jeopardize national security. So even the House Oversight Committee minority leader, Adam Schiff, says, don't give us the documents. I mean, it's the opposite of oversight. Please don't show us.
Yeah, it's total role reversal, because now it's the Republicans in the form of Devin Nunes who want this information made public, because there may be a scandal here related to the FBI. We don't know. We won't know until there's an actual investigation. And finally, Rod Rosenstein said this morning that he's asked the FBI Inspector General to take a look at this. So there very well may be something behind it. Adam Schiff doesn't want us to know, because now he's trying to protect the FBI.
Well, it's also funny because the implication there is that Adam Schiff is saying that he can't secure the documents from leaks.
Don't show me because I can't control them. And maybe I'll leak them. Stop me. Please don't give me any documents that'll help me carry out my oversight function.
Stop me before I leak again.
Exactly. 30 seconds left, Ted. We've entered a new stage. And, you know, Trump is making also the case there wasn't any collusion. So the Mueller probe is going on now to Saudi Arabia, UAE. And of course, there was collusion, as there is between the Saudis with every presidential campaign, Democrat or Republican. Go ahead. 30 seconds left.
Yeah, well, we are entering a new phase. The question for me is how the media is going to handle this. This goes really contrary to their narrative. And it's going to be interesting to see whether they're forced to cover it, or if they're going to just put their hands over their ears and go, la, 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 we can't hear this.
I think that's exactly right. And again, this is something we're going to have to revisit because it's an ongoing story. We were joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. And you can find his work at www.rall.com. That's RALL.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
At least 10 prominent women's rights activists were arrested in Saudi Arabia over the weekend and this morning, just 6 weeks before the kingdom was supposed to lift its ban on women driving. Two men also were arrested. The women have been outspoken in their support of a woman's right to drive and in their opposition to the male guardianship system, where a woman may travel only with the permission of her father, husband, or brother. The arrested men are known for having created a literary salon that allows both men and women to attend. The government said that the activists had, quote, formed a cell that threatened Saudi security, unquote. We're joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Ali, this does not sound like political reform to me. What are we looking at here?
It would be if you were listening to the Saudi detractors in Washington, and even some human rights organizations who are saying this is a good step. What's happening here, this is a dictator, a despot, the bad thing. So everybody else is in jail. The only one left are the soft, you know, women rights activists. So they had to end up in jail like others. So this kind of mentality does not allow for the tiniest of dissent or difference of opinion. So this is just to show you the real face of Saudi Arabia, the real face of the Saudi crown prince in particular, MBS, who could not tolerate his own mother and his own brother, that he threw them, behind bars. So this is nothing new. It's not a surprise for me. It will surprise some people who are in the U.S., maybe in the West. And, of course, it's embarrassing to the Thomas Friedman of this world, to the Ali Shihabi of this world, who are touting this guy as a revolutionary. It's disgusting to call this guy a reformer. It is even more disgusting to equate him with reformers who actually did change, for the right or wrong, like Atatürk or Jamal Abdel Nasser. So really, this guy is just a despotic leader who does not like dissent whatsoever, no matter where it came from.
Thomas Friedman has some lifetime tenure. I don't know what he has over the New York Times.
I don't know.
He's wrong about everything.
Everything.
Wrong about everything. He's in love with MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, great reformer. And yet here we have these women's rights activists charged with very heavy charge. I mean, like, you can't get heavier.
Well, look, they have the Saudi bots on on Twitter have been publishing the phone numbers of these activists, calling them traitors. And basically, that's a death penalty in Saudi Arabia. And the Saudi newspaper as well calling them spies. And that's death penalty. And I personally did this yesterday and the day before. I reported tweets from Saudi government bots calling these activists spies and traitors, which is death penalty in Saudi Arabia, and calling for their punishment. I reported these tweets to Twitter. They haven't done anything. The same Twitter who suspended my accounts, accounts, for doing nothing. On this, I presume on the Saudi request. So it's not only the journalist who might have been paid to say this, but also companies like Twitter and Facebook and others who have participated. Twitter, for example, has killed every hashtag started by these women activists to end the guardianship law over 300 times, by the way, not one hashtag, because every time they kill a hashtag, then they put a new one and they put a number to it, and the number surpassed 300. So it's the same hashtag, end of guardianship, one, two, three, this, and every day they kill it, and it takes it. It was trending, and then they kill it. Twitter, nobody else can do it, but Twitter can kill the hashtag, and the you know, it's continued until now. I think so. I don't have any Twitter account to check, so it was all the more suspended. Even the inactive one with zero tweets, they suspended them.
Ali, tell us something. The law on women driving is supposed to change in 6 weeks. It was heralded in the West as this incredible leap forward for civil rights in Saudi Arabia. Well, now all of the most prominent women in this movement have been arrested. In fact, one of them is 70 years old.
Yes, yes. There are two of them. Two of them, actually. Two of them. Aziz al-Yusuf and Aisha al-Mana are in their 70s. And let us remember, it was King Salman, who, when he was a governor of Riyadh, who sent these people to prison 27 years ago when the American forces were there to oust Saddam from Kuwait. They were arrested and they were threatened. They were fired. And one of them actually had a mental breakdown. I know her. She lives in Virginia because of this experience. She's completely, she has lost her mind because of the experience. So now this is happening again for the same people who have no political opinion, who have no political plans, and they're called spies and traitors. So there is strong report that the issue of lifting the ban on women driving will be delayed. This is very customary in Saudi Arabia. They did it with allowing women to vote. They delayed it by 6-7 years. So we might see this because things are not ready, the laws, and they will make excuses. And I think it's my personal opinion, with based on what I'm hearing, it's not going to happen the end of June, and they will make excuses because the same thing when they did with the women participating in voting and running for these powerless, useless elections for municipal councils. They did the same thing. They delayed it by 7 years.
Ali Al-Ahmed is our guest. We're talking about the arrest and the very heavy charges placed on women and men who are advocating women's rights in Saudi Arabia. Here we had when Mohammed bin Salman was here, he came to Harvard. He was greeted by MIT, DreamWorks, Oprah, you name it. I mean, it was a love fest with this great reformer. Now putting all of these people as Ali is saying, maybe everybody else is already in prison. But I want to ask you, Ali, we have about 4 minutes left. I'm looking at the New York Times from May 19th. The article is entitled, Trump Jr. and Other Aides Met with Gulf Emissary Offering Help to Win the Election. And I'll read it real quick. Beginning, 3 months before the 2016 election, a small group gathered at Trump Tower to meet with Donald Trump Jr., the president's eldest son. One was an Israeli specialist in social media manipulation. Another was an emissary for two wealthy Arab princes. The third was a Republican donor with a controversial past in the Middle East. That would be Eric Prince, kind of Blackwater. This meeting was convened primarily to offer help to the Trump team, and it forged relationships between the men and Trump insiders that would develop over the coming months, past the election and well into President Trump's first year in office. I mean, Ali, there was collusion between Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates with the Trump campaign in 2016. And it seems to me that even though this is obvious, that this is, I mean, it seems obvious to me. I mean, we'll have to see the hard evidence. Not that big of a deal, though. I mean, still the focus is about Russia, even though actually there hasn't been substantial or I'd say any hard evidence of it. Anyway, was there collusion with the Saudis?
Well, the Saudis have been involved in loss in most elections, presidential elections, for the past decades, two, three decades maybe. And in 2004, the head of Corvus, John Petrello, gave John, the VP president, you know, for John Kerry, John Kerry's running mate, John Edwards, a good sweet deal on a house in McLean. And it was an exchange of getting a favorable thing. So it was a way to support them. And the Saudis in 2015, both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, when after the election, after Hillary Clinton made her, you know, candidacy known, they both met with King Salman in Washington in the Four Seasons, and money was exchanged. And contract for the Podesta group was given after that a few weeks later for a Saudi contract. Podesta is obviously a Clinton aide. And same thing with the Bush administration, with George Bush giving, trying to support his brother Jeb to win the presidency. So they do it through contracts. They do it sometimes by giving cash. And no FBI investigation was started. And this tells you, this is an issue, is an anti-Russia, let alone, you know, and not a foreign intervention in U.S. elections, because the Saudis have been doing it for a long time. UAE has been doing it for a long time, and it's not raising any eyebrows in Washington with the FBI or others.
Ali, I think Tony Podesta, who is now the leader of the Podesta Group, the lobbying agency that was co-founded by John Podesta and Tony Podesta, and John Podesta was Hillary Clinton's campaign manager. Tony Podesta, or the Podesta Group now, has actually been compelled to register as a foreign agent for Saudi Arabia, right?
Yes, I think what they did, they closed the Podesta Group, John Podesta was in Saudi Arabia about, I think, 10 days ago with the Center for American Progress. So this is one way of making of getting paid through these nonprofit organizations and getting the Saudis. So we knew the financial ties between the Saudis and the UAE and many American officials are deep and have not been investigated by the FBI.
And this has been going on for generations.
It's bipartisan, Democrats and Republicans.
It's bipartisan. You know, the UAE ambassador gave cash to congressmen in their offices. So
that's what we need, another FBI investigation. Well, in any event, we were joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. You can also check out his work at www.billayers.org. Bill, it's always great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Bill, there's so much in the news about education right now. I mean, it's like really topical, breaking news almost every day. Let's start with comments by the Texas governor and lieutenant governor responding to this shooting in the suburb of Houston a few days ago about hardening schools. The lieutenant governor in particular said something that was so ridiculous. It was one of the most ridiculous things I've heard in the context of these school shootings that we're seeing. He said that the solution is to have only one entry and exit so that it's more easily guarded. Now, he ignores the whole notion that Well, he ignores every notion. I'm going to turn it over to Bill. Bill, what do you think of this?
Well, I think the whole concept that has become a Republican talking point and an NRA talking point that we need to, quote, harden the schools is catastrophic. I mean, what we need is not concrete poured over our schools. What we need is not a single entrance. What we need is freedom from violence of this kind of violent culture and the kind of handgun insanity that's taken over. So we really need softer schools, not harder schools. We need schools where relationships drive things. In fact, there's actually a lot of evidence that when school shootings have been avoided, it's been because the relationships between teachers and kids, between kids and one another, actually allows people to check a problem before it gets out of control. That's what we need, not the hardening of schools. It's really a catastrophic conversation that we're having now in a really dismal political landscape.
And the whole issue of metal detectors, there's been a number of studies done now about what actually happened, as especially like New York City or maybe in Chicago where you are, where urban high schools were just look like locked down military events with checkpoints and metal detectors. If anything, it only led to additional punishments, especially of Black and Latino kids. It didn't really do a thing in terms of actual safety.
Well, that's one result, and that is always predictable, that when you have a criminal justice kind of response to a social problem, it always means more people, more vulnerable people, more marginalized people targeted and put in cages. That's always true. But there's a second thing to note about the hardening of schools in New York and Chicago at a certain period, which is the shootings moved outside. And so Kenwood High School, which is just two blocks from where I live, they didn't have a school shooting inside, but they had a lot of people shooting outside. And that is insane. So the idea that somehow schools become these safe zones because they're covered with concrete and the rest of the world will go to hell is itself quite crazy. There's another point which I'd like to bring in, which is while the Republicans and the NRA are saying harden the schools, which incidentally is a kind of disgustingly male metaphor, but in any case, while they're going in that direction, liberals like Arne Duncan, the former Secretary of Education, are putting forward really idiotic proposals. So Duncan and Peter Cunningham, one of his associates who was Democrats for Educational Reform, they're saying that parents should boycott schools. They should stop going to school altogether as a way to prevent school violence. It just kind of blows your mind that the right wing is saying pour concrete on the schools and the liberals are saying, no, withdraw from the schools. And that's the kind of range of debate we have. Rather than a sensible look at what schools can and should be doing to make them vital life spaces, spaces of peace, and kind of what the society needs to do to come to terms with the kind of sickness that's loose in the land.
That's so true. I want to turn also to, a couple of issues. We, of course, we're pressed for time, unfortunately, which we always are, but there are a couple of really important things that are happening. The press for the last week, Bill, has completely ignored the North Carolina teacher strike, and that's unusual compared to West Virginia, Arizona, elsewhere that we've seen. But I actually Googled it this morning, and I saw that no major media outlet has updated anybody on the North Carolina teacher strike in the last 6 days. So what's happening in North Carolina?
Well, what's happening is the same thing we've been seeing across the country, which is people are fed up with austerity. They're fed up with the attack on public education, and they see it emanating not just from the federal government, but they see it coming from state governments that have a faith-based, fact-free love of tax cuts, but they don't take into account that tax cuts, you know, radical, dramatic tax cuts also mean the end of public education. So what we've seen sweep the country is an anti-austerity, broad-based, teacher and community-led effort to fight for public education. This is what's going on in North Carolina. And the only thing I can speculate is that the reason it's being ignored is because this is one of the tactics that power always uses. They ignore you, they ridicule you, they try to seize control of the narrative, and that's kind of the nature of what we're witnessing. I don't think it's going to work. I think that people have really reached a point, and this rolling red tide of teacher actions, and it's not, again, it's not just teacher actions, teachers in cahoots with parents and community, fighting for public education. This is not going to go peacefully into the night. It's really something that's catching fire, and people are learning from one another. North Carolina learned from Kentucky, learned from Arizona, learned from West Virginia. I see this as a harbinger, a very hopeful harbinger of things to come.
And another thing that won't go quietly into the night is the education system and controversies in education in Puerto Rico. Fully one-third of Puerto Rican public schools have closed in the last 6 months. And charter schools now are popping up all over the island, thanks to Betsy DeVos. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, Puerto Rico is a tremendous case in point, and it reminds us of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, when Secretary of Education Duncan at the time said this is a great blessing in disguise because now we get to make the system from the bottom up. It was a classic endorsement of disaster capitalism, and what we're seeing in Puerto Rico is disaster capitalism on steroids. What's wonderful, and this is also not reported, is that the resistance to this has been massive and spreading. So on May Day, Puerto Rican teachers, 7,000 teachers, I believe, in public schools, you know, across the island, mobilized and had a demonstration. Many were beaten and arrested in street clashes, but it was an example of teachers fighting back and saying, no, we're not going to lie down and watch our school system, our public schools closed, our teachers laid off, our pensions ripped off. We're not going to allow this to happen without speaking up. It behooves all of us, I think, to pay attention to Puerto Rico because it too is a harbinger of things to come.
There's another international aspect to this whole education story too, and that is demonstrations earlier this month in London against a U.S.-based private education firm called Pearson. They have some plans for Africa. And again, this was only carried in the Daily Kos. It did not appear in the mainstream media. Tell us about that.
Well, exactly. What Pearson, for anyone involved in schools, knows Pearson. It's a massive monopoly around testing. It makes its money on reducing education to a testing regime and then selling the tests and selling the curriculum to the schools. There's been some resistance to it in the United States, I think a growing resistance in Puerto Rico to standardized testing as the way to evaluate and understand what schools are up to. But of course, not to be outdone, Pearson and other corporations look abroad and say, well, if we can't market it here, say we can't market tobacco so much in the United States anymore, we'll go to Asia. Well, what we're seeing Pearson do is say, okay, we have some limits on our market here in the U.S. Let's go to Kenya. And they are planning a massive invasion of Kenya with charter schools, with stipulated curriculum sold by Pearson and then tested by Pearson. And what we saw in London, where they were having their annual meeting, their stockholders meeting, we saw a protest which included Kenyan legislators, educational activists, other activists from Africa and from the United Kingdom, protesting this very, very harmful move into Africa and into privatizing public education and selling it off to American corporations.
Let me ask you a follow-up there, because we're talking about countries that are very poor, countries that struggle to provide a decent education for many of their citizens. And these private, what do they call it? Education in a box, I guess,
yes.
that Pearson and others sell. It's all very expensive. Where does this money come from? These countries are so poor to begin with.
Well, the money definitely comes from somewhere. And where it comes from is taking money out of other public services, including education, and channeling it to the private sector. You know what it reminds me of is 40 years ago, when breastfeeding was becoming very popular in the United States, and they were trying to figure out people like Gerber, I believe, and other kind of baby food corporations trying to figure out where to find more market. They began marketing in Africa and Latin America, and the marketing was all about, look at this shiny product we have for the United States. Look at these healthy, beautiful-looking babies. Your baby could look like that too. Don't nurse. Buy formula from us. Well, that's the same thing we're seeing here. We're seeing an attempt, a classic colonial attempt to take over and to drain resources from the public purse into private corporations based in the first world. And that's really a crime against humanity, and it's happening right in front of us.
It is indeed, and it's something we'll come back to as well. We're out of time, though. That was the voice of Bill Ayers. Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. You can check out Bill's work at www.billayers.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we begin a new weekly segment called Connected Lives, Private Profits with Chris Garaffa. Chris will help us look at technological issues that shape our world and how we can fight to maintain our civil rights and civil liberties in the face of increasingly advanced and sometimes hostile technology. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome.
Hey, Brian and John. Thank you. I'm excited to start this new segment.
We are too. And we actually have a lot of things we could talk about. There's one thing in particular, though, I'd like to start with, and that's the notion that body camera maker Axion is considering adding facial recognition technology to police body cams. Tell us why that's important and why it's potentially dangerous.
So it's definitely dangerous because let's say you're at a protest or a rally or even just out on the street and witnessing a police interaction, the police will now have the ability, if they have these new Axon cameras, to get your face on camera. And we know that police, through the Department of Homeland Security fusion centers popping up all over the country, have access to facial recognition technology. So this is a very scary privacy issue for people that are just possibly even out on the street or engaging in protected First Amendment protests.
You know, it reminds me also of this technology that the police have where they just vacuum up license plates as they're driving down the road. They have these devices installed on the backs of police cars now that kind of look like radar cameras.
Yeah, they're tag readers.
Tag readers, yes. And they literally take an image of every single license plate that they pass and automatically process it to see if the car is stolen or if the tag is stolen or if there are warrants out on somebody. That's all fine and good. But where this is dangerous, in my view, is that it's a surveillance tool, and it allows the police to conduct surveillance on literally anybody in America without probable cause and without a warrant.
And it's a little bit like the metadata collection.
Yeah.
Because they can tell through the tag readers almost every place you've been and in what time you were there. So you can almost completely map someone's existence by the aggregation and then coordination of this kind of data.
Right. It's not just where you go, but it's how often you're there, what time of day you're there, and then through the aggregation, who else is there with you when you're there at a certain time. And we should say, this is not just police that have that technology, the license plate, the tag readers. If you drive through an E-ZPass style toll collection area and you don't have one, or even if you do, they're checking license plates because they need to bill you if you don't have the tag. And also, especially here in New Haven, and I know in many places around the country, private contractors for the police, like towing companies, also have them. And that's how they find your car on the street and tow you if you have, you know, tickets or taxes, but, you know, that are overdue, which significantly affects poor people.
I want to go back to the issue of the real-time face recognition.
Yeah.
I'm looking at NPR, a coalition of civil rights groups, including the NAACP, ACLU, and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, immediately responded to the announcement with a public letter urging Axon to exercise caution in deploying AI, artificial intelligence technologies. The coalition wrote that American law enforcement has, quote, a documented history of racial discrimination, close quote, claiming, quote, because Axon's products are marketed and sold to law enforcement, they sometimes make these problems worse. I have to say, Chris, this seems to me to be a very weak letter. One, you're asking Axon, civil rights groups asking Axon to, quote, exercise caution. And also, because Axon's products are marketed and sold to law enforcement, they sometimes make their problems worse. I mean, the entire appeal here is to this corporate entity that's providing the technology to law enforcement to do the right thing. I mean, they're not going to do the right thing. Let's face it. I mean, they don't care about the right thing. They care about selling equipment to police agencies. I don't think that's the way that this can, you know, society can get this under control.
I completely agree. I read this public letter, and while I was happy that something was published, I think it's extremely weak. And I think to even say there's a documented history of racial discrimination is significantly underplaying the current situation and how we've seen just in the past number, you know, few years, so many cases of racial discrimination at the hands of police directly or when police respond to calls. We've seen this from situations in Starbucks, situations right here at Yale University recently, and of course the many, many cases of police brutality that have been caught on camera and the stories of which have been shared. This is a significant issue, and I wish that statement had been stronger, demanding that they had not, that they do not publish this or create this technology and use it, because you're absolutely right. It's going to make Axon money, and that's what their bottom line is.
Chris, I want to talk about something too that that you flagged for us before we went on the air that I think is so incredibly important and has been overlooked really by the media, and that is that the next version of Apple's iOS, its operating system, will shut off the USB port after 7 days of non-use, and this will block the tools that law enforcement use to gain access to seized phones. What does that mean? It'll shut it off.
So this is actually some good news that we can talk about, which has been a little rare, right? Apple is part of their marketing strategy, part of their corporate existence is to focus on privacy, which it makes money for them, but it's also very good for people. So one of the things that's coming out in the next update to iOS, the software that runs on your iPhone and iPad, is this feature that if you don't use your phone for 7 days, it's going to turn off the connector on the bottom that you would use to plug it into a computer, and you have to put your passcode in order to reactivate that. So what that's going to do is block law enforcement or somebody who even steals your phone from accessing stuff on your phone. We know already that there are companies that sell devices. The main one is called a Gray Key. They sell devices that try hundreds or thousands of passwords in minutes to unlock phones, to get around Apple's security. So this is going to be an exciting new feature, and I would encourage everyone who has an iPhone to update when this update comes out.
We talked 2 weeks ago on our show about the police in a town in, I think it was Texas, correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, that they wanted, the cops there wanted to unlock a phone. They had killed the owner of the phone. And they were trying to justify their use of deadly force. And so they went to the morgue with his phone and tried to get his thumbprint from his dead body to activate the phone. They were not successful, but it was a clear and naked attempt to circumvent the laws that require a warrant.
Yeah, and it was completely self-serving. The guy
totally.
Was dead.
He was
they
dead.
They just wanted to justify them having killed him, which in fact was an unjustified killing. Of course, that category doesn't actually exist in America for police officers.
No, they don't even count that kind of thing. Oh, I'm wondering if this iOS update that Apple's come up with is in response to the San Bernardino case that we saw a couple of years ago, where Apple went to the mat with the FBI and in the end just would not allow the FBI to crack open the phone of this shooting suspect. And so the FBI director, James Comey, said later that the FBI spent $1.6 million to hire hackers to finally go in and open the phone for them.
That's right. They actually hired an Israeli firm that developed some of this same technology that we're talking about here to get into that phone. Apple got a lot of really, really good PR from privacy-minded people over that the San Bernardino case where they refused to help law enforcement unlock that phone. But we should say that they do cooperate frequently with local law enforcement and federal law enforcement, just not in this case. I do want to point out, when you talk about fingerprints, people should be aware, too, that the courts, this is still going through the courts in many ways, but initial rulings are that while your password, you know, a numeric or alphanumeric string of letters and numbers, is something, it cannot be compelled, you can't be compelled to give that, you can be compelled to use your fingerprint to unlock your device. So people should be aware when they're dealing with law enforcement that that could be a situation that they get into. And you can mention that Apple phones, if you tap the power button 5 times, it actually shuts off the fingerprint recognition as well.
Wait a minute. Repeat that. That's like the most important thing I've heard since I don't even remember when. Repeat that so we all understand it.
So if you tap the home, side button, the power button on your Apple phone, it'll actually turn off the fingerprint reader so that you have to put your password in. And courts have ruled that you can be compelled to use your fingerprint to unlock your phone by law enforcement, but you cannot be compelled to give them your password to your device. So if you're pulled over, tap that side button 5 times really quickly, or if you are, approached on the street by police, just tap that button really quickly 5 times.
Wow. Did you know that, Brian?
Of course not.
That's the most important thing I've heard concerning civil liberties since I don't even know when. My goodness. Okay, well, we're just about out of time, so we're going to wrap it up there. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. This was the first in what's going to be a regular series for us on Monday talking about technology. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Kirill Vyshinsky, a reporter for RIA Novosti Ukraine, the Ukrainian bureau of the Russian news agency, was arrested in Kiev last week and charged with high treason. The Ukrainian government accuses Vyshinsky of, quote, subversion by means of information, unquote. The NGO Reporters Without Borders says that it is deeply worried about the journalist and is calling on the Ukrainian government to release him without delay. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. Mark, good to have you.
John, Brian, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you for joining.
Mark, what exactly does this mean in the greater context of Ukrainian-Russian relations? Kirill Vyshinsky is not the first Ukrainian journalist to be arrested and charged with treason. He's the third in the past 8 months or so. Now, none of them have yet gone on trial. With that said, high treason is a very, very grave charge. What does this all mean?
Well, in the greater context of Russian-Ukrainian relations, it means that relations are not going to improve anytime soon. In fact, they seem to be spiraling ever downwards, although every year it seems like they couldn't possibly get any worse. Then, things like this happen. And like you said, this is not the first case, within the last year of this happening. This has happened repeatedly now. And in the greater case of Ukrainian relations, it's also a signal that there is no sign of peace within the country, because the government is, that is in power in Kiev anyway, has shown absolutely no signs of reconciling with the east of its own country, the Minsk process has effectively been just not just ignored but actually legislated against, much less having any of its political conditions fulfilled. So, things are going to continue. Now, since this regime seized power in 2014, there have been over a dozen journalists and media workers killed in Ukraine. What all of these journalists and media workers have in common is they were all critical of the government that seized power in Kiev. And we're talking Ukrainian journalists, Italian journalists, other foreign journalists, Russian journalists. And this doesn't even count the large number of citizen journalists. The number of people in Ukraine, according to their own media, have been arrested simply for making social media posts critical of the government that is now ruling out of Kiev is also extremely high. It's something to be scared of. We have heard condemnation of this from the Committee to Protect Journalists and Reporters Without Borders, who have said that if the Ukrainian government actually has any evidence of the crimes of treason, then it should present them or release them. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe has done it. Even the United States State Department has said that Ukraine has made a muted statement that the Ukraine needs to respect international law with regards to journalists and so on. But if I could indulge you for just a minute, the Committee to Protect Journalists website, this, I'm just going to scroll down and read the headlines of the articles this year, just in the last few months, about Ukraine. Ukraine authorities search Russian news agency, detained director. That's the most recent. In Ukraine, journalists harassed, one attacked while filming investigative report in May. Prosecutor in Ukraine flouts court, refuses to return journalist's passport. That's in April. Journalist faces extradition from Ukraine to Azerbaijan, fears for his safety. That's in March. In Ukraine, at least two journalists injured at Kiev protests. That's in March. Local news website in Ukraine torched, server attacked. That's in February. Week after raid, office of Ukraine's Vesti news agency remains blocked. That's in February. Ukrainian law enforcement raid Vesti offices in Kiev. That's in February. Editor flees Ukraine after receiving death threats. That's also in Ukraine. That's also in February. I'm sorry. So that is the state of conditions for journalists and journalism in Ukraine today.
Mark Sloboda is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM, 1390 AM. You can subscribe to this as a podcast at iTunes and also now at iHeartRadio. Mark Sloboda, let me ask you, because the Ukrainian government is making the comparison with a Ukrainian citizen who was arrested in Russia, whose name is Roman Suchenko, and he's accused in Russia of espionage charges. When you go through that litany of what you just read, it shows a remarkable pattern. But what Ukraine is arguing is that perhaps this is a tit-for-tat arrest. The Russian Foreign Ministry has said not at all that these were accredited journalists, the people who have been arrested in Ukraine, while Roman Suchenko entered Russia illegally. Anyway, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I don't think that there really is much of a comparison. Ukrainian journalists regularly operate and criticize the Russian government in Russia. The one in question, Suchenko, he was not accredited in Russia as a journalist. He is recognized and has been reported in the Ukrainian press as being employee of the Ukrainian military intelligence agency. He was not apprehended while doing any journalistic, certainly not any accredited journalist activities. He is being charged with evidence of espionage, not of a crime like treason, which is just, you know, the performance of your journalistic duties if you happen to be critical of your own government. So I think it is kind of facetious to try to make comparisons between these two particular cases.
What's the punishment that's likely here for the Russian journalist arrested and charged with treason?
I think he will probably receive a charge, in court. But I think he will probably, in the end, be exchanged quietly or released. We've seen a number of these type of public, shall we say, witch hunt cases where journalists have been arrested, charged, and then received some type of suspended sentence or otherwise released afterwards. It seems more that this is a type of attempt to intimidate and to stop journalists from doing their work than it is of any type of serious threat here.
And, you know, one of the interesting things, too, if I could interrupt you for 1 second, is that none of these journalists who have been arrested have in any way advocated violence or separatism or anything at all. In fact, they're all on the record as supporting a peaceful solution between the Ukrainian government and the Russian government.
And then Ukraine's government in the indictment talks, again, this is the kind of banal but insidious language that's being used all over the place, including here, that the Russian media is weaponizing information. Well, what does that actually mean to weaponize? Is it like putting it on a tank and shooting it at people? I mean, what does it mean to weaponize information? You're telling a story that doesn't conform to or comport with the government's narrative, and thus you've created a weapon. I mean, it's anyway. Go ahead, Mark. We have about a minute and a half left.
Yeah, I mean, we've heard this, you know, these hysteria out of Western media. There's very little that Russia hasn't weaponized, be it information, be it film, be it music, be it, I mean, there have been large numbers of musical performers from Russia arrested or banned in Ukraine.
Weaponized music.
Imagine.
Yeah, weaponized music, simply because they made public statements that were critical of the regime that had seized power in Kiev in 2014. This is a continuing process. And the worrying thing about all of this is not only, of course, does it happen, officially, but sometimes the more dangerous is unofficially. There is what presents itself as an NGO. It's not in any way non-governmental group in Ukraine established in 2014, called Mirotvorets, okay, which translates as quite ironically as peacemaker. And this group compiles a list of enemies of Ukraine, meaning specifically the regime that seized power in 2014, and they have this is run by a former member of the Ukrainian intelligence security services, the SBU. It's actually curated by the security services of the SBU, and it has been promoted and protected by the Ministry of Internal Affairs of Ukraine. Of this list of enemies of Ukraine, we have seen it has listed some 4,508 journalists who have simply, from around the world, including many Western journalists, normal, mainstream, very critical of Russia journalists who either have reported on the conflict in Ukraine or have reported in the east of the country, which resists, the authorities in Kiev or in Crimea or elsewhere. At least one journalist and one parliamentarian who have been listed, what this website does is it reveals their name, their addresses, their family members, all kinds of personal information. Two of them have been assassinated.
Wow. It's a war against press freedom.
It is. That was the voice of Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.